that door, and I don't know, Representative Gardner, if you want to, who's going to bring up the housing language?
I got a memo drafted, and I have Mark Brenner was going to talk about it, and then we'll have Representative Gardner. Yeah, and so this is the 8:30 amendment.
Did we get it passed out? Why don't you go ahead and explain it, and then you've got to, okay. We'll wait until the members get out.
R-1-186.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and our concern with the current language in the bill is that it's first let me just back up and say what it addresses, and that is the Manufactured Housing Relocation Trust Fund, which was established by the legislature in 2007. It was a bill issued by Representative Kranz as a way to address the issue of manufactured home parks that may close at some point. And what the fund does is has residents or the homeowners pay $12 into the fund. It's collected by the owners of the manufactured home parks, and then the money is deposited with the with MMB as a part of the trust fund. If there's a closure, those homeowners who are displaced would receive some compensation to relocate their home or to perhaps have their home acquired or bought out. The owners of the manufactured home parks also pay for some of the relocation. I think up to $6,000 or $8,000 per home also would go to the resident in the case of a buyout. So the program that was established has been in effect for 2 years. There were a few issues or concerns with the collection methodology, but it is working. One of the problems had been that some of the owners of the properties weren't necessarily aware of the requirement that they collect the money. Another issue was that some of the homeowners actually didn't want to pay. They were told by their owner that you owe us this $12, and they said, well, why? And said, well, in case this property closes. And then it's, well, are you closing? No, we're not closing. Well, that's okay. I got things to do. It's Friday night. I'm not going to give you $12 if you're not going out of business. There were a few of those issues. So we worked last session with the advocate groups on legislation to try to help streamline the collection process. The idea then was, and the legislation was heard, that we would put the $12 on the personal property tax statements of each of the homeowners as a way to collect that. There were concerns expressed by the counties that this would cost millions of dollars to reprogram computers to do it, and others were concerned that it set a bad precedent for putting things on a tax statement for other collection purposes than the taxes. So we worked again last summer and came to agreement on legislation that was also introduced originally this year by Representative Gardner, which would have used the refund program for the renter's credit. When the homeowners would have received their refund for their renter's credit, they would have had $12 deducted from their refund, and that would have gone into the fund. And the problem with that was the way the state accounts for that money is it comes from the general fund. It didn't come from a dedicated fund, so it would have been about $500,000 cost, which these days was significant in terms of that getting any traction. So what we have in front of us in terms of the amendment is actually a compromise or some, an agreement that was reached in the House several weeks ago that put in place sort of a new system of collection that has the Commissioner of Finance sending out a statement to the owners of the manufactured home parks telling them that they're required to pay the or to collect the $12 fee, which took care of the issue of people weren't aware that they had this responsibility. It also left in place the current system for collection that was working. You have somewhat of an adversarial relationship in terms of a landlord going to their tenant and saying, I'm collecting this money from you. But the system was working fairly well. It wasn't necessarily adversarial in terms of the relationship to collect. So the idea was we'd leave the system in place. The fund is in the black. It's solvent. But we would put some teeth in place as well for those owners of the manufactured home parks who did not send in or even attempt to collect their fees from the homeowners. Then they would get an invoice, and what the amendment does is put in place the concept that then they would get the invoice from MMB telling them that you owe us 12 times the number of licensed home sites that you have. And the reason we think that the amendment is important, and one of the reasons that we supported it in the House, was that it at least allows those owners that are trying to collect and diligently from their residents the ability to do that. If the residents don't want to pay or participate under the current program, they don't qualify if their home closes. One of the concepts of the fund was it's like an insurance program. If you participate and if you pay, then you'll be covered. What the current bill does, or one of the things we're trying to change, is essentially says that it now shifts to a program that the landlords are required to fund. It's no longer a homeowner fund or a program. While the current language in the bill would allow the owner to approach the property owner to approach the homeowner and say, you owe me the $12. If they don't pay, that would be fine. They'd still be covered. If they want to collect the money, the $12, they could go to court under the eviction proceedings in the statute to try to collect the $12. Well, they're not going to do that over $12. They're not going to ruin a relationship with a resident who's typically paying. So what we're concerned with is that it simply won't get collected. I mean, while the opportunity is there, they're not going to attempt to file an eviction notice over the $12. So what the amendment does is leaves in place the current system, which is working. For those owners who don't attempt to collect the money from the homeowners, they will get invoiced from the state, and we'll essentially have accomplished what we set out to address at the beginning of the session with the original bill.
Representative Clark, do you have any comments or Gardner?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would maybe ask Representative Gardner to speak. This was the language we have in the House was the result of numerous meetings, and I actually thought, and I was told, people came together and negotiated. It actually took quite a long time. It didn't happen the first day of session. It took a number of months, and we finally have the language that we then, I thought, in a bipartisan way, approved and put in the bill. And maybe Representative Gardner could say a little bit more about it. This is like going backwards again, it seems to me. I'm not sure why we would do that.
Mr. Chair, I know you've got other $100 million figures to haggle over rather than $12 ones, but I did actually get the park advocates, the residents who were over there, and the park owners over here together because they couldn't agree on how to best collect this money and make the fund solvent. And I thought we had a consensus, and then the park residents looked at what I drew up, which is kind of what's in the A30 amendment, and they hated it. And they just don't want to go along with that. So Representative Morgan, without any objection from me, amended the bill to make it look like the Senate language, and so now you have identical language in the side-by-side. The advantage to what you have in the Senate, or the side-by-side, which is if you leave everything alone, is that it's very simple. Every park owner, all 900, get assessed, and then they collect either through rent or a one-time lump sum, the $12 or $1 a month via the rent, and then that just reduces the processing cost for the state. So what you have on the side-by-side now is simpler for the state, cheaper for the state. I have been interested in trying to get people to get to an agreement, but they didn't. I'm an advocate for the park residents. I'd like to work with the owners if I can, but we just couldn't work it out. But I think what you have here right now on a side-by-side is fine, and again, we're talking about how to collect $12, so I hope this doesn't take too much of your time. But I do have the park residents here if you need any questions answered on the day.
Representative Gunther, you're off of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Bruner, you have another amendment that you wanted to have heard. You want to hear that one, or you have any comment about Representative Gardner's statement?
Well, I think, and I appreciate Representative Gardner having worked with us, and actually it was in his office when we talked about the language that we're bringing back that really sort of brought us together, and I know that there was some disagreement on the process, but you know we believe that this would work best just in terms of the owners complying and how they conduct. I mean, you have nearly 1,000 of these. Essentially, they're small businesses in the state that have, you know, there are about 50,000 homeowners in the state. So, you know, while they could collect the $1 a month, if you will, or in a lump sum, the $12, you have to give written notice every time you want to collect. If you choose the dollar a month route that's in here, you have to give each homeowner a notice every month. Probably 85% of the 50,000 of these homes, they don't get a monthly rent statement. I mean, there's a lease agreement that's required by law. You pay your rent each month. You drop it off at the office. And that's the extent of it. And so what it would require is, a notice every month. If you wanted to add it into your rent every month, you'd have to give a notice, which you don't even give right now. So, you know, again, you know, those are the kinds of things that just mechanically don't really fit well with, and we all want the fund to work. I mean, we're not saying, gee, you know, we don't think this is a good thing. We were all in the governor's office when the bill was signed. And, you know, we just really would like to continue so that the program does work and that they do pay in. And we think putting some teeth in here, invoicing people who don't pay or contribute will go a long ways, as well as the notice requirement that the state sends every owner saying you've got to collect it. We think is a huge leap in the right direction.
Mr. Chairman, this is the hardest $12 to collect that I've ever seen in my entire life. I think if they got the option of paying in a $12 lump sum or once a month on the rent, I think we've solved the problem. They'll figure it out. They can't do it now, so I think I don't know if you got some other amendment that is acceptable to somebody else, but this amendment just puts us right back to where we were at the start, and it's just going to cause as many problems as they had before. And I think we should take one of the two bills, and I don't care which one.
The language that's in there. Mr. Chairman, maybe.
Yeah, one says shall, one says may on the.
Well, we have the amendment. Fees. We have the amendment before us.
I oppose the amendment.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No, I guess it does not prevail. Do you have another amendment on this issue?
There's another amendment, one that represents Clark quite better than the first one.
Yeah.
Would you like me to move that one?
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move the A31. I'm sure we can figure out a shorter way to describe it.
Well,
it'll be all for two.
Essentially, as a part of the requirement under the trust fund, there's a report that's issued each year on the balance in the fund by the Housing Finance Agency. What the amendment does, and actually the only change you'll find is on the back of the back page of the amendment, page 4, and it's essentially adding language that in addition to what Housing Finance Agency puts in their report to the legislature each year about the fund, that it would include any administrative expenses or charges that are essentially taken against the balance in the fund for the department to administer the program. That's not specifically a part of the requirement for the report, and that's just a cleanup provision or something to add to the report so we have a better idea of how the money is being spent that's in
any
the fund.
Any discussion on this?
I think that's okay.
Okay, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
That motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to move that language then as amended?
Well, do you prefer shell? Court shall award prevailing party reasonable attorney's fees or the court may. So it's
Mr. Chairman, in the committee there was quite a bit of discussion and the House preferred may, and that was bipartisan.
186. I don't have. Okay, I'll move on.
Any
every time somebody then moves the house.
I think Nolan's something here.
What mine does?
It's on R186.
R186.
188, 159.2.
So 186, starting in there?
It's R186, on the house side, R186, subdivision, or section 1, subdivision 6, the line 156.26 through R188. 159.2.
Okay, with the amendment added on. Okay, any questions on that? If not, all those in favor, please try to say an aye.
Aye.
I'm motion for this. I was wondering, I was hoping that Representative Murphy would be here, but Senator Tomasoni, we have all of the different boards that I don't have in the House under my committee. Under Representative Murphy, so the Historical Society, is there somebody here from the Historical Society that we can get a little bit of an input maybe as to problems you may have or which different, what you like better, whatever. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society.
Mr. Chairman, members of the conference committee, I'm Michael Fox. I'm the Society's Deputy Director for Programs.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has spent a lot of time listening to discussion about job creation and job preservation, and I couldn't help but think that some of our colleagues back at the History Center and around the state at historic sites may be facing the tough situation that others will be are facing today. So we would sincerely appreciate any effort that you can make to help preserve our budget and our service to the public, both at historic sites and at the History Center. I think there's been a lot of discussion in the media about historic sites and what may happen with historic sites, but there's a lot of other activity that takes place at the History Center. People who do work that's not as visible to the public, but is important to our generation and future generations for our ability to learn about the past. So we would appreciate. We understand the difficult challenge that you all have, but we would appreciate any efforts to help preserve our budget.
And Mr. Fox, would you care to add anything?
Well, I think the implicit in that is the number of positions that we're going to lose as a result of the budget cuts that are before us. You may have seen in the media references to the loss of 94 positions across the society, 94 FTE positions. Many more individuals are affected, but over 300 people would be affected one way or another, in addition to 10 vacancies that exist that would be vacated. At the level in both the House and the Senate proposals, those are reduced significantly in terms of the loss of staff, our ability to keep our historic sites network as whole as we possibly can, to keep those sites that would be closed under the governor's proposal to avoid those closings. Although there will be reduced hours across the network in any event.
Questions, Representative. Either one of the testifiers, at what level of a cut during this time of a budget crisis do you think the Historical Society can afford and should absorb? Delaware, do you want that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, we certainly understand that there's a large deficit that you all have to solve, and it's a challenge. We've been through this before with your committee in the past. Certainly the level of reduction in the House bill or in the Senate bill, which is a little bit lower and would save a few more positions, it would be difficult because we would be doing layoffs of a number of staff at that level. But that would be a level that certainly would be preferable to higher levels that have been proposed.
Representative Dr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelleher, if we had the same funding as we had how much would you suffer with this? How much more do you want than we had before? We gave you everything that you had last biennium, this next biennium. Everybody got paid the same. Everything's the same. How much would that affect you? I thought we had levelness. We didn't cut you. We didn't increase you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, are you asking how many?
How would that affect you? In other words, how much inflation do you need?
Just to hold your own.
Just to hold your own. You know, everybody's giving up quite a bit.
Sure.
Some more than others. How much can you absorb? And if we kept you level with what you had last biennium, this biennium, how would that affect you? Would you support something like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, that would be wonderful. We would deliver the same level of service to the public that we do now. I think that, you know, the inflation levels that we face for salary inflation and materials are probably going to be less than they have in recent years, which obviously brings the overall cost of doing business down.
Mr. Chairman, I know you're somewhat different in that you get paid by two hands, one the Historical Society and the other one by the state. I look at how much can you sustain, and not knowing how much you are increasing over last year, maybe you do.
Well, let me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, let me, you quite aptly point out that we have two funding streams here, one from the state appropriation and the other on our non-state side. We anticipate a $2 million shortfall annually on the non-state side going forward in the next biennium. So even if the legislature and the governor were to continue us at the present level of our general appropriation, we would still be facing a $2 million shortfall, which would be represented across the cuts. So when you see things in the press, and it's probably 60-40. The total shortfall we have is about 60% as a result of a reduction in the general appropriation and about 40% coming out of the reduction on the non-state side, reduced admissions, sales, revenues from investments and general gifts from members and other supporters. So even if we were to be made whole in our state appropriation, we would still be facing a significant reduction in our budget.
Chairman, go ahead. That's just because of the level of giving will be down.
The level of giving will be down. Interest in our endowment will be down. We are anticipating fewer people will be able to come to our historic sites and our museums in the present economic climate.
Okay, well, the governor cut over 2.5. Are we comparing apples to apples in the House and the Senate with what the committee did it? I know we cut more, but I mean, you did some things.
The Senate is what, about $600,000 a year higher than the House, and the House is about $1 million a year higher than the Senate, or than the governor. Is that?
That's correct.
And Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons ours is the way it is because we subtracted out the lease payments and the debt service before we applied the 7% reduction. So we made sure that they could pay the rent and pay the debt service and then applied the reduction. So that might be the difference between us right there.
That is correct.
And I know Representative Murphy liked that idea. We probably shouldn't make a decision.
All right. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Any other questions? Is there any language that's different than any other dealing with the historical society?
That one usual about the pan charge general.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the legend. Is it the same?
Yeah.
you don't have to. The Senate doesn't.
We don't have any.
Oh, well, that, you'll have to.
People coming to the Capitol that can't charge for tuition.
We'll have to speak to the chair.
We'll wait then for tomorrow to have the gavel to talk to Representative. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
How about the film board? And then we'll take the arts board. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Colleen Tellison with Explore Minnesota Tourism, and with me is Lucinda Winter with the Minnesota Film Board. Explore Minnesota administers the funding for the Film Board, and just as a statement in general overall with the budget, as a statement in general with the budget, we appreciate the budget that's provided to Explore Minnesota, and the difference appears in the Film Board for the Snowbait program. And I can just give you a brief summary of the Snowbait funding since it has been reinstituted in the 2006 session, and then Lucinda can give you specifics in terms of outcomes from the funding. The Snowbait program was reinstituted in the 2006 session at $1.7 million. And during that time, there was an end date on the funding, which resulted in some of the money not being used for the Film Board because of the end date, but it was rolled forward. So in the 2007 session, $1.3 million in funding was provided for Snowbait for the biennium. And with that, there was also a change that provided that the money would be available until expended, so it continues to be available. In the 2008 session, another roughly $1.3 million was provided for the Snowbaits program. And then additionally, we went back to the funding from the 2006 session that had not been completely funded or completely spent. And because that had rolled forward in the tourism budget, we had some legislation passed that allowed the money, $500,000 of that money, to be reappropriated to the Film Board for a special film, which in this case was A Serious Man. So that is kind of the summary of the Snowbait funding up until this point. The recommendation from the governor was $552,000 per year, which would be a reduction from the $650,000 that was provided each year in the last biennium.
Chair and committee members, I think the reason we're here really is to address the difference between the House and the Senate versions. And I obviously prefer the Senate version of the funding for the next biennium. In all seriousness, what we have here is a program that over the last 2 years, and this is on the lead behind, we've generated, we have an FTE formula for film jobs, which by their very nature are temporary. Some film jobs in feature land are very temporary, maybe 4 months on a film. But in TV series, you can go for, there are TV series right now in national cable series that are produced in Minnesota where people do have full-time employment producing those TV series. So there are some full-time jobs. We have a formula, and we've created in the last 2 years 260 FTEs through the Snowbait program. And we've generated $42 million in direct and indirect economic impact in the same biennium. And that was on a reimbursement of on reimbursements of $3.2 million. That's over the last 3 years. The cost of that is 8% of that total economic impact. So it's a cost-effective job creation program. Film and television, in addition, is green. It requires no real infrastructure investment on the part of the state for jobs creation. And according to the U.S. Department of Commerce, spending on Minnesota's motion picture and video industries creates more jobs more cost-effectively than in nearly any other state. So we do that very well. Snowbait, as I said, is extremely efficient. It reimburses production companies only for payments that have been made to Minnesota workers and businesses. And there are other states where this is not the case, and they don't enjoy the same kind of return on investment. Snowbait funds support two brands, two flavors of filmmakers, both independent filmmakers and studio feature people, commercial people. So we really serve two masters. Because we don't have any floor on Snowbait, in other words, if you have a feature film that's a very small budget film, we will support it if you follow all the rules and are eligible for Snowbait. The least expensive film that we have supported was $20,000. That film was made and has made a distribution deal. The most expensive film during this three-year period that we have reimbursed was a $15 million studio feature. So we have made a strategic decision to support both the large films and small films. The limitation on that being that with our current funding level, let's take a $15 million feature. If I write a reimbursement to that one feature, I'm done with these funds. So the reason for the increase in funding and the reason I believe it's supportable is because at this very time when we really, really need quick stimulus, quick jobs creation, if we were to be provided with the Senate version of these funds, at the very least we could bring several large feature film studio features that pay union wages, that rent hotel rooms, rent cars, rent condos, rent people's homes, all the things we need in our economy right now, as well as supporting some of the smaller, more homegrown productions. So we're asking for the additional funds because we know we can use them, we know we can spend them, and we know that we get good results in terms of jobs and jobs creation and economic development.
Question.
Mr. Chairman, just might make a comment, Mr. Chairman, that we put the extra money here based on the fact that films in Minnesota create jobs and the economic impact is tremendous. And by having a little bit of extra money, they have the ability to actually attract films that they might not be able to attract. And we had the experience on the Iron Range with North Country. I was a $250,000 investment. Turned out about $2 million to the economy in about 2 or 3 weeks. And so it's pretty significant. And so that is the reason for the jobs investment part of the Snowbait that we have in our bill.
Yeah. Well, we got a little bit of a difference here.
There's a pretty big difference, so I understand.
Until Representative Murphy gets here tomorrow morning, or tomorrow. Any other questions? Thank you. And then,
excuse me, could I just add one other comment?
Sure.
Okay. I was told that this might be the last opportunity I might have to ask if there would be any way for you to consider a change in my ops contract, not my Snowbait contract. I have two separate ones, so that we are under a grant program with Explore Minnesota Tourism, where we for every dollar that we raise, we receive $3 of our state appropriation, but not until we raise the private funds first, which creates a real dilemma for us July 1st, because we've spent down our state funds. And I have to run the office in July, and yet I have to be raising funds to make my match. And one of the questions I had, which would be administrative in nature, would be if there was any way we could receive some of our funding to get us kicked off for the year, because in July I spend so much of my time worrying about payroll. It would be great if we could in some way modify our contract so that we'd receive some part of our state funds, allowing me a couple months to fundraise to make a match on the rest, if that makes any sense.
Senator, you follow that?
Not a clue. July 1st is when the money starts flowing, so I don't know if we can do it. What do you think?
Mr. O'Rourke, the problem that the film board encounters is not that the July 1st date happens. What happens is they end up trying to spend all of their money in their accounts by June 30th. And then as soon as July 1st kicks in, they then have to raise $100,000 in private money before they get any of their state.
We have to raise some money.
They have to raise their money. So what the film board has asked for is a little longer time, or give them a period of time to raise their private dollars, so that they're not stuck in the spending, trying to spend all their money in 1 month and then have zero money the July 1st, basically. I don't think it would change the match at all. It just gives them a little more time. Yeah.
We'll try to work out some language
on
that. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chair, and what are we talking for dollars? You're talking about payroll for a couple months, so about what that amount.
Right. I mean, if we could even have $25,000 or $50,000, and I would expect then, I mean, it's not a problem of it being July 1. It's just that it's especially because fundraising has become very challenging. We've always been able to make our match for the last 3 years. We've always been able to fundraise the money and get our complete appropriation. It's just that the first month of the year is really stressful because I'm coming up against the end of the month and trying to make sure I have enough. I've collected enough private funds. So even if I could have, say, $50,000 before we have to start matching, that would be great.
Senator.
And, Mr. Chair, and just to follow up, this would not negate the match in any way. This would be from your existing appropriated funds.
Right.
It would just be that jump start.
It's sort of just in, right.
Senator Cook, I think you could probably have some language there that gave them, you know, up to, hit 20% or whatever their money is, so that the match, get the match, but up fronted it right after that July 1st. And what would that be then in dollar wise? 120?
20% of 325.
Yeah. Up to $50,000. This appropriation should be made available on July 1st.
We'll work out.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay, anything else?
No, we just want to, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak tonight.
And then we have also the, tourism, and we should probably have the arts board. Is there somebody here from, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. And with me tonight is Larry Redmond, who is with Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. We are two separate organizations, but we serve the same purpose and serve the same set of constituents. And so he will share some thoughts with you as well. We appreciate the chance to give you our thoughts on the two versions of the bills. And first of all, we want to thank both the House and the Senate for doing all they can in a difficult budget year to find cuts that might be manageable for us and cuts that might minimize damage to a significant industry in Minnesota. The arts and cultural industry in Minnesota is about a $1 billion industry. It supports roughly 22,000 full-time jobs in nonprofit organizations, large and small, and artists who are usually sole proprietors. We touch about 18 million people in a biennium and serve all 87 counties through the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council. So it's a significant sector of the state's economy, we believe. If we were to choose the House or the Senate position, it would be a little difficult to do so because there are strengths in each of them, and I'll share those with you and possibly give you a thought to consider. The Senate version is obviously the deeper cut, but one of the things that it does is keep the line, and I'm looking at the text version of the bill, it keeps the line that's labeled operations and services at $651,000, which is level with our 2008-2009 appropriation. And the reason that's important to us is because 6 years ago when the state was facing a similar difficult economic budget problem, the overall appropriation was reduced by about 30%, but that particular line was reduced by 61%. So we've really been trying to fight our way back from a significant deficit position. The advantage, obviously, in the House version of the bill is that the bottom line is bigger, and it would allow more money for the Arts Board, for the Regional Arts Councils, and for our operations and services line. So if we could suggest one possibility is if you are able to choose the House version, what we might ask is if you could try to keep the operations services line at $651,000 and then take that extra $51,000 out of the grants line and move it. And not to seem like we're disadvantaging one of our three areas, the base that's being used for fiscal 10 and 11 is actually higher than the base that we have in fiscal 9. And that's because in the 2007 session law, an increase was written into the language. And so overall, the Regional Arts Councils and the grants line, if you could make this adjustment, would both be at about a 7% reduction. So those are my thoughts on the bill, and I think Larry has some things he'd like to add.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Larry Redman, representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. I just want to reiterate our support for the description that Ms. Jens has made to you tonight. We represent the 1,600 arts organizations that are in every county of this state and are active. They also include all the regional arts councils that support the smallest arts activities through our state. And we think there's a very significant and a very positive system, one that, frankly, is well known throughout the country as being one of the most diversified and far-reaching ones that's there. Very specifically, I should tell you that our emphasis in terms of looking at state arts policy, frankly, is not so much specifically how big the agency is, but whether or not it's really outreaching Minnesotans, you know, through those organizations and so forth. And as a result, sometimes we're budget hawks. In fact, there are times when Ms. Jens and I will have conversations where we have a sharp pencil because we want to see money out on the street and in all of your districts and those organizations. But I want to make clear today that as much as we've played that role before and played even at times been critical of some administrative dollars, we very much support Ms. Jens and the State Arts Board's remarks about their operation line. Unfortunately, during the very significant budget cuts of several years ago during an earlier financial crisis, the administrative line of the State Arts Board was very severely cut and not restored. This has materialized in serious problems in the field. We believe, the field believes, that the State Arts Board is being hampered presently in terms of overseeing some of the performing their oversight roles in making sure that the grants are going out, and we're concerned about that because the integrity of that system is very important to us. We think they're doing a great job. I don't want any misunderstanding about that, but we think that we've kind of cut into the bone in that administrative line as much as we want those grants lines. And so we appreciate the fact that in this very, very difficult time, both the House and the Senate have kept the reduction significantly less than what was recommended by the governor. We're very appreciative of that on both sides, but we agree with that, the position that Ms. Jens indicated to you earlier.
Question? Okay. Thank you very much, there. Is there anybody from the humanities that wants to come up and... Public broadcasting?
I would want to say that on the Humanities Commission that's in my district, they'd really like the Senate position.
Move it if you want.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Nelson. I'm the Public Affairs Director at Minnesota Public Radio, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I won't spend a lot of time on Minnesota Public Radio. We've completed a lot of testimony already this year, but as you know, about 6.8 million hours are spent in Minnesota listening to Minnesota Public Radio each week. Minnesota Public Radio uses its general appropriation for capital purposes only, and to build stations and to help fund equipment improvements in parts of the state that couldn't support a full-power radio station due to their population density. So in partnership with the state of Minnesota over the past several years, we've been able to build stations in greater Minnesota where we would not be able to build stations otherwise. And our network has now grown to include 34 stations and 33 translators throughout the state of Minnesota, serving 5 million people throughout the state. We have two requests before this body. One is for our equipment grant, our traditional equipment grant, and we are planning to use that to build three new full-power stations in greater Minnesota, one in Ely, Hinckley, and International Falls. In the House version, it sticks to our base budget of $380,000. The Senate version increases that to $500,000. That will really help us to build two of those full-power stations. Our other request is for digital conversion. It's $500,000 to complete the digital conversion of all of our stations in Minnesota. We have completed the conversion for 27 of them. This would do the remaining stations. Unfortunately, both of these requests are on a very short time frame. We would, understanding the difficulties the state is facing, we would try to delay these projects. When it comes to the new stations, we have a window where we apply for an FCC construction permit. We received permits for Ely, International Falls, and Hinkley. Those permits expire. When those permits expire, we lose the station. We lose the ability to build that station, and they expire in 2010 and 2011. So we don't have the ability to push this off into future years. We've also secured $1.1 million in federal matching money for this, for both of these projects, both digital conversion and the new stations. Both of those matching dollars also expire. If we don't get the state support, we will have to return those federal dollars to Washington, which is something we certainly don't want to do. And unfortunately, Minnesota Public Radio does not have discretionary dollars to fund it ourselves. So that's the situation we're in, and we really hope that you're able to go with the Senate's recommendation for this funding.
Questions then of the public broadcast?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You get about, could you give me an overall budget for NPR and then what percentage of that is your state funding, what is private?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman and Senator Cope, NPR's annual budget is approximately $71 million. On average, if you look at our base amount, it's less than 1% of NPR's annual budget. In the past few years, we have received one-time capital dollars to build new stations. We just completed a new station in the Roseau-War Road region, and that does slightly increase the percentage. So over the last 2 years, it's varied between 1% and 3% of our annual budget from the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hani, did you want to come up for the humanities zone? I don't know what you say. You like the Senate position?
Mr. Chair, my name is Kathy Hani from Fagry and Benson, and we represent the Minnesota Humanities Center. And quite honestly, Mr. Chairman, I thought it was the same on both sides.
You like the Senate side better.
Do I? Okay.
Yeah. You got a little more money.
All right. That's right. That's right. I forgot. The House nicked it a little bit, Don. Yes, we strongly prefer the Senate position.
Any questions on that, Senator?
Mr. Chair, just given the current situation of the economy, why should the humanities be held harmless?
Representative Koch, you know, that's a good question, and the House did reduce it a little bit. It is, we do get base level funding of the $500,000. Even at the base level funding, it's really sort of bare bones. In addition to the base level funding, which they used to help pay for the maintenance of their building, they still need to raise both federal funds and funds from individuals and other entities in order to fund their operations, which is the main focus of their operations is on the professional development of teachers. And so to do all those kinds of things and the outreach that the Humanities Center does, they need to raise other additional funds. So, you know, if you think of the $500,000 base level funding, it's really to keep the lights on and the building operating. So whether you think you should cut them back a little bit or not, but it doesn't give them much more than keep the building open.
And, Senator, they did a really nice movie on the Iron Age.
Mr. Chair, I know about that. I wish I could have seen. Oh.
Senator Koch, we're glad to have you there and show you the movie.
Quite frankly, they had teachers from all over the country up on Iron Age this summer, and they really did a nice job of explaining our part in the industrialization really of the country. And the teachers, Senator Tomasoni came and spoke, and Representative Sertich and myself, and
the teachers. It was great.
Yeah. They did a wonderful job, and the teachers really enjoyed it. They got particularly got a kick out of Senator Tomasoni, but Representative Mahoney.
Well,
Mr. Chair and committee members, it is in my district. One of the things that is just down, it's on my way to the Capitol, so I get to pass it when I'm going to work, and sometimes when I used to get home before dark, it's very well used. I will give it that. I mean, cars are in the parking lot, people going in and out quite a bit, so the facility is not unused. I mean, it is very well used.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, you know, we've got a number of items that are all the same on those small boards. Do you want to move all those items? Or did we do those already when we did the? We didn't do any money yet.
Are you
right?
Saying no? Are you talking like on R-29?
I'm talking the Board of Accountancy, the Board of Architecture. That's, you know, some of them that aren't exactly the same. Are those, I thought we had three or so.
Well, we've got, on page R-29, we've got a whole bunch of things. You want to move those through?
Which page are you on?
Representative Murphy, do you think, should we move all of those appropriations on page R-29, excluding the $500,000 grant for public broadcasting, since they're all the same language there?
That is two different. I think the public radio is also $160,000 for each year on the Senate side. So the equipment grants are line 20.15.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's the only difference besides the 19 and 17 to 20, right?
Yeah.
So, is there a motion then on the excluding 19.17 through 120 and 20.15 through 20.17? Got the motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. So do you want to talk while we're here about the barber and cosmetology boards, which we gave them an annulment?
Mr. Chair.
It was a divorce, Mr. Chair.
We looked at it as an annulment.
It was a divorce.
Well, I was going to say, should we do the Board of Accountancy, Board of Architecture, and Board of. I guess.
And that would be it.
That would be it, I guess.
Yeah, those are exactly the same. So, Senator Tomasoni moves Section 15 and Section 16 and the money on page R31. Any questions? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And motion prevails. On the Board of Barber and Cosmetology, other than Representative Murphy, most of our committee supported it, and Representative Gunther was the minister at the marriage and then the
lawyer
at the divorce, I guess. So, I don't know if you have anything to add on it. We kept the money the same that was requested by the cosmetology mm-hmm. board, and we had finance, I believe, allocate the funds and split them up as they come in separately, which they evidently kept track of anyway. And so that's our proposal. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, does it need any more language to for year to year, as years go on, separate money out or anything else, or to make this a cleaner, clearer break? I mean, I don't want to have them. I don't want to see them come back next year asking us to fix up, paper over some differences that we might have to, that we might miss this year. So
So that's my only concern. Do we need any more language that separates them?
I think Ms. Newman probably took care of most of what we needed to do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, by giving the Commissioner of Finance the authority to allocate the funds, they will be accounted for separately, and in the next biennium, it will not be a combined appropriation anymore. It will be a separate. The Board of Barbers will have an appropriation, and the Board of Cosmetology Examiners will have an appropriation. So they'll be completely distinct entities.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
For those of us on the Senate side that didn't get to witness the divorce, I guess I'd just like to have an explanation of the breakup, because this is all new to us.
They had a pretty nuptial.
Representative Gunther.
I'm glad to give it to you. I'm the one that started them. Governor Cui eliminated the Board of Cosmetology, and they weren't anxious to start any more boards for a long time. And consequently, the cosmetologists spent $2 million a year and got 1.5 inspectors and a test taker. So we didn't think that was right, so they didn't want to start any boards, so we went and we asked the barbers, would you accept the cosmetologists